I'm Marty Moscoe-Wayne. Welcome to Radio Times. Alex Wagner is a familiar face on TV as a contributor to CBS News and co-host of The Circus on Showtime and as a former daytime host on MSNBC. She says that seeing a 1993 Time magazine cover featuring a computer-generated face of a multi-ethnic woman with the title The New Face of America got her thinking about her identity because that image kind of looked like her. Wagner's mother was born in Burma. Her father's family is from Luxembourg. They met while working for the Teamsters in Washington, D.C. Alex is their only child. That picture, her family's romantic, even gauzy stories about their journey to America and being questioned about her appearance set her on her own journey to understand her family's history. She interviewed relatives, dug through archives in Burma, also known as Myanmar, and in Luxembourg, and she had DNA tests done on her grandmother, her parents, and herself. Her memoir is titled Future Face, A Family Mystery, An Epic Quest, and The Secret of Belonging. Alex Wagner joins us here in our Philadelphia studio. Nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
It's great to be here. Thanks for having me, Marty.
You're very welcome. So what started this epic journey?
Well, I was a kid that always thought of myself as, you know, generically American. I liked Garfield and Saved by the Bell, and I just thought I was like everybody else. And there was this sort of inflection point when I was 12. I was sitting in a diner with my dad. My dad got up to go to use the restroom, and the line cook looked at me and said, "Are you adopted?" And it was the first time in my life where I thought, wait, the way I see myself as just kind of a generically American kid, the daughter of this white guy from Iowa, because of course I was, it was the first time that I realized that the way I saw myself wasn't the way everybody else saw me, and that the sort of it was impossible for this person to imagine that I might be the natural born daughter of a white Irish Luxembourgian American. And it made me question, okay, well, where do I belong and why am I not of this place? Or why am I not seen as being of this place and of this father? And as I grew older and in my high school years, I saw that Time magazine cover that you mentioned. And that sort of opened this door into this exotic mixed race identity where it didn't matter where you were from. Your past didn't matter. All that mattered was your sort of future face, the fact that you were an avatar of mixed race America, the brown destiny.
You were the future.
Exactly.
Right?
And that was exciting for a time. I think in my late teens and early 20s, I willingly and enthusiastically adopted the mantle of Hapa, you know, mixed race being. But at a certain point, especially as I have gotten older and gotten into my real adult years, there's a weightlessness to all of that, not being rooted in any particular narrative, not knowing who my quote-unquote people are. And this book is my journey to try and find those people.
You're also a relatively new mother.
Yes.
Just having a baby also, she says, with exhaustion on her face.
With her eyeballs, her eyelids heavy and
but
drooping.
Does being a new mom, though, get you to think about family and your child, obviously, his future?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, being pregnant and finishing writing this book, you are acutely aware of the inheritance and the narrative that is told to you about who you are and where you came from. And one of the things I discovered in the course of writing this book is that the sort of way in which we'd been telling our family stories was disingenuous. It wasn't a full accounting for how we got to the places we got and what we left behind. And I felt actually really proud of having finished this book and having had a child at the same time, because it made me realize that I could start the story in a different place. And the story that I would tell my son would fundamentally be different and I think more truthful than the stories that I'd been given as a child.
I don't think there's anything unusual about having families that tell mythical stories about how they came to America, who they were. Even lying, even misrepresenting who they are. I always think it's risky to do the DNA, which you did, but also to begin to mine some of these stories to find out what's true and what isn't true.
Yeah. And so there are two parts of this. I mean, let me just let off a lot of families, and my family is included in this. They don't have the time and the resources, the energy to do the exhaustive genealogical work that I did. And a lot of people take these DNA tests because they're kind of like easy version of being told who you are. But as I discovered taking a number of tests, the science behind them is spotty, you know, and depending on where your people are from, you're going to get more accurate results than other people. And I certainly got a number of incredibly wildly inaccurate results. One
about the Scandinavian part of your family,
right? One test told me I was 14% Scandinavian, which is not a small amount. I mean, it's enough of an amount that I was immediately, you know, sort of justifying what I saw as like Scandinavian traits in myself as being a natural progression of my, you know, ancestral lineage. Like, I love Swedish meatballs and I'm going to start celebrating St. Lucia Day. All these, like, you know, it was completely concocted. And in fact, as I unpacked the science, fraudulent, this 14%.
That would be the word.
Yeah. But the genealogical work, which is much more truthful and honest, and I highly recommend it insofar as it gives you a much firmer grasp on your family narrative. It's hard, and it does uncover skeletons in the closet. I mean, piles of bones is probably more like it when you really get to the nitty-gritty.
Well, in fact, you say once you pull the skeletons out of the closet, you really can't put them back.
No. In fact, what you realize is the tableau that has been painted by your parents and grandparents, mm-hmm. and to some degree we fill in parts of the tableau ourselves as children, that once it's been fractured, you can't put the image back together. And that's hard. You know, I think there is a necessary sort of romance to ancestry that, mm-hmm. like, gives us strength in times of weakness or when we feel like we've fallen short. We hold dear this idea that somehow we are better than this particular moment. But once you find the full accounting of what actually transpired, we realize mm-hmm. fundamentally that we are broken and we are human like everyone else. My thinking at the end of this was that that was a good thing because it made me much more empathetic about the mean present that we happen to be living in.
You just
today.
Did a Freudian
yeah,
slip
I
there.
I didn't mean to say mean president. But this president has, I think, in a lot of ways given us, I think we understand and feel the fracture in our landscape in America around identity. Then it's more powerful and more at our front doorstep in a way that it hasn't been since I've been alive.
You know, I was thinking about the fact that you're a journalist, you're a broadcast journalist, and when you begin to dig into your family's life, you become, in a sense, the journalist of your own family. But then you find, you know, the fake news.
Yeah.
That's part of family.
Oh, the fake news. I mean, there was my grandfather on my great grandfather on my Burmese side was always discussed with hushed reverence. He was a top sort of government official, right? And I had never really asked any questions about that. And then when I dug deeper, I found out that he played a not insignificant role in precipitating financial and economic calamity in Burma, where thousands of people saw their entire life savings wiped out. I mean, it was never clear to me, and I don't think it was through malevolence, but it was definitely incompetence that led to this on a number of people's parts. But my grandfather, or great-grandfather, was implicated in this. And what I realized was this idea that he was some vaunted, you know, proto Ben Bernanke of Burmese agrarian finance, that was fake news. And it's interesting that you say it's like, you know, you have to play the role of journalist.
You do.
There were moments where I thought, am I being too tough on my family? Am I being too hard, easy on my family? But you do have to constantly gut check when you're doing this kind of research.
Well, let me quote you. You say, in trying to get a wider look at my family history, this is what I discovered. My people were weak and dishonest and stupid and corrupt. You are hard on your family.
Yeah. I mean, I will say, and I say that with love. I mean, I think that it is not a one-sided indictment of my family, but I think it's also important to realize that we did make stupid mistakes. We were weak. We were corrupt. We were also loving and smart, and we tried. I mean, it's every story, every family story, like every human story, is incredibly complex. The question is whether we have the courage to look at the flaws.
I'm curious about the response of your family to the book then, because you have unearthed some things. You've punctured some holes in the family myths.
I will say two of the key narrators in the story passed away, so I didn't ever get as much of a reaction as I had hoped to, right? My mother wants everybody to know that she disagrees with some of the characterizations of her in the book. And, you know, the book is in part, you know, my mother, I love my mother and I give her a big thank you at the end of the book because she was incredibly willing and forgiving of, you know, some of the conclusions I reached. And I think was also, it was a, she woke up, I think, to a lot of the complicated Burmese history that is in some ways still playing out today with the genocide of the Muslim minority inside Burma. That all of that ties back to Burmese history of the not so distant past. And I think she was happy that I had tried to sort of put the pieces together. I don't think she co-signs on all of the conclusions I take about, you know, her own bigotries and some of the sort of racist tendencies within our own family. But you know what? I didn't write this for everybody to agree on the conclusions.
You wrote it for yourself.
Yeah, well, I wrote it also for other people who want to better understand who they are and what it means to go through this journey to find out what family and people, who determines who our tribe is.
Well, and we're in a time, we've been here before, where we fight about immigration and who's American and who should we allow in and who gets tossed out. But thinking of your mother who went to Swarthmore here,
yes,
just outside of Philadelphia.
City of brotherly love.
Came as a young woman, obviously settled in the United States. Was she fleeing Burma?
She was. The Burmese military junta had just seized power, and they had decided to – they were nationalizing the country and its businesses, and they were very suspicious of families that had connections to the international set in Rangoon. And my grandfather was the undersecretary of education in Burma. Both of my grandparents in Burma had been Fulbright scholars. They'd studied abroad. My mother studied at a British, British language schools in Burma, and they became targets. It became very clear that the government was going to try and curtail their activities and that they were trying to sort of box my mother in terms of what kind of education she got. And that was a bridge too far for my grandfather and grandmother. And they said, we have to go. And they had to leave, you know, largely under cover of night. They weren't issued passports, or my grandmother and mother and uncle weren't issued passports. And it was all very secretive. And my mother didn't come back to Burma again for 40 years. And
wow.
I was the one that made her go back to Burma.
In fact, we're almost having a break here. When you decided to go back and, I guess, see where she came from, but also to try to figure out some of this family history, looking through the archives, how difficult that was.
Yeah, it's hard going home again. It's hard going home again, and it's hard going home again, especially when home bears no resemblance to what you left.
Things are not where they were before, probably look totally different to her as well.
Yeah, the closest metaphor is like that of a sunken ship. You know, you can still recognize the outline of the hull, but it's covered in barnacles. And that's what it was like for her to go back to Burma.
And that's Alex Wagner, our guest on Radio Times today. She's got a new book. It's a memoir called Future Face, A Family Mystery, An Epic Quest, and the Secret of Belonging. It's in many ways about her family, their family before they came to the United States, and what happened when they got here. She is a co-host of Showtime's The Circus. She's also a CBS News correspondent and a contributing editor at The Atlantic. You can join us at 1-888-477-9499. You can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. And do stay with us. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscoen talking with Alex Wagner about her life. Let's talk a little bit more. I wasn't sure.
Just a broad topic.
We have 40 more minutes to squeeze your whole life in on the air here. But as you mentioned, your mother came to the United States from Burma. Now it's a country that other people refer to as Myanmar. Aung San Suu Kyi won the Nobel Prize. She was leader of the pro-democracy movement. She's now, I'm not exactly sure what her title is, but she is...
She's the de facto prime minister. She's barred from becoming the premier because of the way the military junta rewrote the constitution before she was released from house arrest. But she's leading the country.
But such expectations, you know, on what she would do for Burma, Myanmar, and how she would bring in democracy and more openness and freedom of the press, none of which has happened.
Yeah.
And also the Rohingya, which you referenced before.
Yeah. So, I mean, just for people who don't know Aung San Suu Kyi, she was Burma's Mandela for a while. She was under house arrest for, I believe, off and on 12 years. And for people like me, the children of exiles, I mean, she was a way of carving a Burmese identity where there so much existed in a void, right? She was, I mean, we all had shirts and we talked about her, and she was the one Burmese person that people outside of Burma knew, right? Like, people would say, oh, isn't there that woman that's under house arrest? And they'd say, yes, Aung San Suu Kyi. And I remember feeling such a heart-swelling pride talking about her. And so when she was finally released and became a real political force, I think there was a real expectation, as you say, that she would be able to help Burma, which has been basically shrouded from the rest of the world for the better part of half a century, that she would help usher in this much more progressive dawn. But as it turns out, now, and I talk a little bit about this in the book, I mean, there is this very fierce and virulent strain of nationalism that a lot of Bamot Burmese share. The Bamot Burmese are sort of an ethnic minority that's at the top of the caste ladder, if you will, in Burma. And Aung San Suu Kyi is Bamot. And her father, Aung San, was the independence hero of Burma. He was also a fervent nationalist and had co-signed a number of writings that demonized the Indian Muslim minority. And Aung San Suu Kyi has very much followed in her father's footsteps and that of national, you know, she is very much, her polling numbers are up because Bamot Burmese inside Burma are very nationalist, and they believe, they see the Rohingya, the Muslim minority, as outsiders who don't belong in the country, setting aside the fact that some of them have been there as early as 7 AD, right? But there is this tribalism that we often like to think of as just the sort of problem America is grappling with. But in fact, it's dealt with all over the world, and very much so in Burma. But, it, you know, I will say, as a Burmese person, it has been heartbreaking to see a woman who was, you know, I mean, I can't tell you enough how much I identified with her struggle and felt an investment in it. And she has been such a – she's proven to be such a fraud. And has so fallen, I mean, to say fallen short is just euphemistic. I mean, she has crushed a lot of the dreams people had about what her leadership would look like.
How does your family feel about her?
Oh,
and they were, you know, such supporters.
Yes. I mean, my grandmother was out there pounding the pavement, protesting, trying to get arrested in the 80s and 90s as a sign of solidarity with the pro-democracy movement, many of the leaders of which were incarcerated in Burma. She did not live to see this final or this present chapter of Aung San Suu Kyi and her – I don't even know what we call it, but just this shameful period of her leadership in Burma. And I'm glad that she didn't, because I think it would be hard for her to reconcile, right? It would also force a real conversation about the attitudes that even my grandmother had about Indians and Muslims and out, quote-unquote outsiders in her country. But my mother has been shocked, and I think, like many Burmese exiles, is wondering where is the response? Where is the outcry from the quote-unquote educated, quote-unquote good Burmese? I mean, there should be a deafening cry about her leadership, about what's happening in the country, and I feel like we haven't heard it.
Is that, I mean, in part, Aung San Suu Kyi is not a member of your family, but she was obviously someone that your family and you looked up to. When you, you know, dig up all these stories, or they are out in the sunlight where we can all see them, does it raise questions about your family's support of her?
Yeah, I think it does. And so, especially because I had never looked at I looked at sort of nationalism as patriotism. It's really instructive in this particular moment, right? When it was coming from my own family, I thought, well, we were very patriotic about a good Burma that once existed, and she is the avatar of that good Burma. But in fact, that kind of patriotism dovetails with like nationalism and the dark, dark, evil, rotten underside of that is what's happening in Burma today with this ethnic cleansing. When that is laid at your front doorstep, it really prompts you to revisit anecdotes and stories and name calling that used to happen in my own family. And I realized, you know, we're part of this in some way. We're not condoning or like going out there to support ethnic cleansing, but the DNA of that gross nationalism and sense of ethnic superiority is absolutely something that we had in our bloodline.
Like the bystander effect,
yeah,
in a way?
Yeah, absolutely. And it like, you know, as shocking and as difficult as that is to swallow, it also informs a present moment when we think tribally about American politics and we're like, well, those people would never be me. Those people that are sort of blind in their patriotism and don't understand the xenophobia as – or don't understand that patriotism is giving rise to xenophobia and nationalism. Well, when it happens in your own family, it gives you a different perspective.
But does it feel like this, the sins of the quote-unquote father? I mean, as a child, once you unearth these things – and I think it should be said, as far as you can tell, there weren't mass murderers in your family.
No one was a commandant of a concentration camp.
So, I mean, there are those families where that does exist.
Yes.
You found imperfect people.
Yes. Oh, you know, there was this famous incident where Ben Affleck took a genealogy test and didn't want anybody – or DNA test – didn't want the information that his ancestors were slave owners to come out. There is no better time than right now to talk about the sins of our American forefathers and non-American forefathers, to sort of have a full accounting of all the bad things we did to make sure that we don't repeat those mistakes again in the future and in the present.
Your father's family came from Luxembourg, very, you know, obviously very different kind of place coming to the United States, settling in the Midwest.
Yeah.
What do we need to know about your father's family?
We had always told ourselves a story about my great-grandfather, Henry Wagner, and how he was a cultured man who spoke many languages and had a sort of an interesting backstory, but we didn't know much about it. I just knew that my father grew up the son of a rural mailman in northeast Iowa along the banks of the Mississippi River, and they went to church every Sunday, and his stay-at-home mother made donuts and bread, and they cooked from this, you know, verdant kitchen garden, and it was all very Rockwellian. I mean, it was
I can
like,
see it.
You can smell the pie, right? I decided to figure out who really was Henry Wagner. And one of the sort of mysteries that popped up was that, A, he might have been Jewish. B, he might have been jailed for treason. And C, where did this land come from? This is, I think, the most universal truth, because the white immigrant origin story in America is a powerful one, especially at this present moment, right? And the story we told ourselves is, oh, we just came here and through dint of hard work and divine providence, we made it. And what a great American story that is.
The industrious immigrant.
Horatio Alger, pull yourself up by your bootstraps. And as it turns out, the more digging I did, I thought, how did we even end up in Lansing, Iowa? The reason we were in Lansing, Iowa, and the reason we got to plant peach trees on the land is because just a few years before Henry Wagner started his kitchen garden, the Winnebago tribe had been kicked off the land, decimated number, and basically killed off in the following years. And it had never occurred to me that our place in this country was secured by kicking someone else out. And it's a very simple homily. We know about the genocide of the Native people in America, but we rarely think about it in the context of our white histories. And as sort of like tedious or obvious as it may be to say, when you actually look at the numbers and the dates and you say, oh my gosh, Henry Wagner was here. Like, they had literally just been kicked off the land and we arrived with our suitcases. That's one of those instances where I feel like when I tell my son the story of the Wagners of Lansing, Iowa, it's not going to begin with the suitcases plopping down on the banks of the Mississippi River. It's going to begin with the story of the Winnebago and how we got their land, and that's how we began. That's how we built our house.
Is it going to include the smell of pies baking as well?
Of course. It's an important part.
It is an important
part. But it's not the only part.
Well, I thought what was interesting is this: there was this thought that, well, maybe we were Jewish because of the kind of, was it Mogan David wine?
For people who don't know, I knew what Manischewitz wine was, but I didn't realize that Mogan David was a kind of cousin to Manischewitz. But in asking and sort of like drilling my beloved family members for family history, it was revealed to me that there was a kind of running theory that we were Jewish, which was as disjunctive as any piece of information could be. We were Irish Catholic. I mean, that was all we'd ever known. That was a huge part of my dad's parochial education, family culture, everything. So to secretly have this like Jewish theory floating around was just total madness. And of course, I was like a bloodhound on the scent. You know,
Want to be? Did that seem like something that you would like
100%. I mean, not just because I was looking for a tribe to call my own, and to be Jewish is to be part of one of the world's oldest tribes, but also because I think I wanted to complicate the family narrative. Uh-huh. I feel like it was too pat. And it was pat because we hadn't been truthful enough. And this would be a way of shocking us into, you know, a clear-eyed view of who we actually were slash are. So I went to Luxembourg and I was in the stacks of the National Archives in Esch, Luxembourg, combing through dusty old books with white linen gloves. I mean, it was I went far in pursuit of the Jewish theory.
And you're not.
I'm not. I'm still like some part of me is waiting for someone out there who's listening to this interview to find some evidence that somehow I and the professional that I ultimately hired didn't find to tell me definitively that I am. But it does not appear that I am.
Alex Wagner is our guest. We're talking about her new book. It's a memoir called Future Face, A Family Mystery, An Epic Quest, and The Secret to Belonging. And again, you can join us at 1-888-477-9499. You can also send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. And you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times to join our conversation. I'm passing this book across the table here just to have you read a paragraph.
Of course. I was not Jewish. I didn't feel particularly Burmese, and Luxembourg might well as well have been Pluto. But in all these places, all these cities, I saw glimpses of who my real people might have been. Carved out from the negative space of my family history, I saw who we actually were. We were storytellers, revisionists, liars. We built our future selves on deceit and half-truths. We plastered our cracks with omissions, as well as genuine courage and smarts and will. In this act of recreation, we became Americans. And I guess there was some kind of belonging in that.
One of the things you say at the very beginning of the book is feeling generically American. Do you feel a different kind of adjective American?
I will say, as complicated as that proposition to be American is in this fraught moment, I really feel invested in this place, in this time. And that's really what I came away with at the end of this book is, you know, this realization that we as a culture are very focused on the past and mm-hmm. very focused on the future. They're intoxicating. They're full of mystery and unknowns. But what is, I think, incumbent upon us in this moment is to reinvest in the present. And in, you know, we're given a limited time on this Earth's crust orbiting the sun. And it's up to us to make of it what we will. We should do so with full eyes, you know, at full, like clear eyes and full hearts, to paraphrase Friday Night Lights. We should do it with a full understanding of what's come behind us, of come before us. But we determine our present. And I think As we lapse a lot, especially given the political climate of the day, into tribes and us's and the versus them's, I think it's really important to remember that we are part of this broader fabric. And like it or not, we're in it together.
Let me quote something else from your book. America's fracturing because its citizens are losing their ability to find that larger story. On both sides of the political spectrum, a movement is growing based on that craving to find a narrative that accounts for us, that tells us who we are. There's a creeping sense that multiculturalism might not be the answer to, but the seed of our discontent, which is slightly different from what you just said, which is perhaps we are falling apart or fracturing, and that this notion, that picture that you saw when you were in ninth grade,
the nebulous brown,
exactly, that somehow that is certainly not everyone's image of what they think the future of America is, or even present day America.
Well, yes, for sure. I mean, by the way, that future face, still in the future, right?
And but it's coming.
Well, inevitably, right? Inevitably. That is our Democratic. What I understood, and I most crucially, after talking to a lot of evolutionary geneticists, is we are much more alike than we are different, and we are destined to travel and globalize and intermarry and be this world is shrinking and will continue to shrink, right? That is somewhat cold comfort, I think, for mm-hmm. people in this present moment who see very steep lines dividing us by race and ethnicity and to some degree gender. What I meant in that passage about multiculturalism is, you know, doubling back and sort of being ascribing your identity to just kind of like this nebulous brown, the salad bowl versus the melting pot thing. Right. That, I think, raises a host of uncomfortable questions about, like, the meaning in that and whether there's true belonging in all of that. And I also fundamentally, this is something I came away from the book with, the idea that identity and belonging is just conferred by race is false. I mean, and what I, the community that we have is filled with people who don't look like us and don't come from the same places as us. And I think that's okay. And I think that's a more truthful accounting of like how we belong in this country.
Here's a comment from Krista. I long for the day when our tribe is just our common humanity, when mixed race is no longer in the vernacular and that all we see is just a person. I mean, I think most of us can hope that that would be our future.
Yeah. Right? I totally agree with that. And I hope the same thing. And I think, unfortunately, part of the bitter pill in all of that is that some of the people that we find abhorrent or reprehensible, and this is on both sides, we have to recognize their own humanity in some way.
Well, and I wonder, too, I mean, there is that myth, that image of the hardworking immigrant.
Mm-hmm.
And also there's that image of the immigrant who takes away my job.
Sure. Look, first, I will say one thing. And I think that this is an important lesson for me in going back to the Burmese heritage, which was we often bucket brown immigrants as kind of the virtuous outsiders who come here and they start anew. And by the way, hats off to all immigrants, brown immigrants, white immigrants. I think this country is made what it is by dint of the fact that we're a country of immigrants. But, you know, we had a history too. And there were plenty of questionable decisions that we should have been more engaged in. And questionable ideas that we held that we should have been more, I think, fully aware of. And I think it's important that we sort of ask tough questions of all sides of our family, of all sides of society. Having said that, you know, I mean, in Burma,
we're going to take a short break. Hold on to that thought.
It's a long one.
I could tell. Yes, we are going to take a very short break and then get back with our guest, Alex Wagner. Again, her book is called Future Face, A Family Mystery, An Epic Quest, and The Secret to Belonging. 1-888-477-9499. Radio Times at WHYY.org. Stay with us. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen talking with Alex Wagner. She's a CBS News correspondent. She is co-host of Showtime's The Circus. She's a contributing editor at The Atlantic, and she's an author. She's got a new book called Future Face. I used to see you on MSNBC, and I will confess, I would say to myself, I wonder what Alex, you know, who am I looking at here? And you have gotten that, I'm sure, your whole life.
Oh,
in many
yeah.
ways, it's what your book is about,
oh,
is
yeah.
what people think you are just based on your face.
Yeah, yeah. There's an anecdote in the book about, you know, for a while in my early 20s, I loved getting confused for whatever people thought I was. And I was wearing, you know, like this one single feather earring, and some guy came up to me and said, "What's your blood?" And I was like so sassy. I said, "It's O negative." Like, oh, how dare you ask me? But that has been long, you know, long. People have long asked, like, been questioning what exactly where I came from.
Have you settled all that? I mean, in certain ways, it was an existential quest that you
yeah.
had.
Yes. If people ask you that question enough, you begin to ask yourself
like, who
question.
Am I?
Who am I, actually? And what does it mean to actually be Burmese, Luxembourgian, Irish? Like, what does that mean other than like a string of like ridiculously far apart places that come together DNA-wise in my body? I didn't know. And that's the subject of the book.
One more question about Burma. A question from Peter. Can Alex talk more about the caste system that she had mentioned? I guess just how intense that was.
Yeah, well,
even today.
Yeah, to be clear, Burma has been engaged in one of the longest running civil wars. That, you know, it's at war with itself to determine the answer to that question. What is the country? It's called Burma, or was named as such by the colonial British, who named the country after the Bama. So it's Burma. And by the way, I always call it Burma because it's almost a form of political resistance at this point. The military junta renamed the country in the 90s in a bid to deflect international international attention from the human rights abuses that were happening. But the Burmese aren't the only people in Burma. They're the Kachin, the Chin, the Shan, the Karen. Many of them have their own armies, and they've been fighting the Burmese military government for independence for a very long time. It's a polyglot country, and it always has been.
Let me just give out that phone number again, and it's 1-888-477-9499 to join our conversation. You can also send us a comment, as Peter and Krista did, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. So you have this relatively new gig as co-host of Showtime.
So many gigs.
The Circus, and we had a little glimpse of what your life is like in the last 24 hours.
Yes, I apologize.
No, that's okay. It's perfectly fine. But what do you hope to accomplish this year? And I was looking at some of the promos and things for the Circus, saying that this was a most consequential year. Maybe not the most, but certainly most.
I think it will be one of the most consequential years insofar as, you know, we are acutely aware in this moment of the importance of the separation of powers, right? And what it means to have Republican rule effectively and the judicial, executive, and legislative branch. I think, you know, depending on what happens in November, there could be very extraordinary implications for this presidency, for the country. And we'll be following it in a way, I think, with a real appetite to find out what's really happening on the ground, which is not something that you get in a lot of just – and much respect to all my brothers and sisters who are holding it down at anchor desks across this country, because that's not that easy either. But the part of the beauty of the Circus is that we're out in the country. I was in Indiana last week. I was in Texas and Florida the week before that, talking to voters, trying to get a real grasp on the sort of national psyche. Mm-hmm. And also – one of the problems, beauties, I don't know what to call it, realities of covering the news in this day and age is there is so much that happens on an hourly, daily basis that at the end of the week, you almost need something to distill what happened, why it mattered, and what it looked like. Yeah. And that's what the Circus does.
So you're talking to what, voters?
We're talking to everybody. We're talking to administration officials. We're talking to candidates. We're talking to voters. I was at the president's rally in Elkhart, Indiana, and, you know, it is a story of two realities, yeah. Right? On one hand, there is a media obsession, and I think rightfully so, a special counsel investigation, the Southern District's investigation into the president. This is unprecedented in terms of American history. But on the other hand, there's a robust economy. There's low unemployment. There are a lot of Trump supporters and people who weren't necessarily dyed-in-the-wool Trump diehards who feel like, you know, the country's on the right track and this guy's got my vote. He doesn't, you know, he's unvarnished. He's an outsider. He's making good on all the things he said he was going to do on the campaign trail. I like him. I don't have a problem with him. Why is everybody talking about impeachment? It is really important to hear that because that's in part how Donald Trump got to office.
Absolutely.
And it's I think it's good to know what's actually going on in the country, especially in states that are really going to matter come November.
You mentioned just what it takes to try to keep up with the news and to bring something different, I think, to the conversation. That's, I think, the really hard part. But I actually thought Michelle Wolf was right on this count.
Michelle Wolf.
When she said, essentially turning to the press people at the White House Correspondents' Dinner saying, you love this guy. You need this guy.
Yeah.
He has made you wealthy. He has made you famous. How do you struggle with that?
You know, I think that it is really important for us. There is there's a lot of honey that attracts the bees, which is to say all of the Russia stuff, all of the, you know, the narrative that this presidency is facing existential threats. It's very intoxicating and the media likes that. And in part, that's driven by ratings. Mm-hmm. But that's why I think it's important for us too, and it's our responsibility to make sure that's not the only narrative, right? I mean, because, like I said, you go to other parts of the country and it's not about spinning non-truths, right? But it is about understanding priorities and what people vote on and how people are elected. And if we don't do our job, we're only covering one piece of it. And that is a piece that may be great for sort of media hits and social media and like, you know, ratings. But the job of journalism is to uncover the truth. And part of the truth is what is actually going to happen with our democracy.
Do you think too many journalists look down on Trump supporters or people who supported Trump?
Look, I think that there's I think that there is I don't know if elitism is the right word to use, but I think that there is a real juncture between the things that people in the sort of Acela corridor talk about, care about, and think about, and the things that people in red states, in rural areas, talk about and think about and care about. And it's not that we need to give them – we need to overcorrect and only cover what's going on with them, but I think we need to be judicious about coverage. In part because people really want to know what's going to happen, right? People want to know – what we're going to do on a host of policy fronts, like, you know, whether it's Paris or Iran, what are the outcomes that we can sort of look forward to? Where is the country heading? Well, you're not going to know that if you're only talking to one subset of people.
You know, I was thinking about John McCain, as I think we all are, because obviously he's battling cancer, and it's unclear if he's losing that battle, but clearly he's in crisis and his family in crisis. And one thing I've just struggled with in the last couple of years, when candidate Trump said, you know, I like people who weren't captured, basically denigrating the 5 years that that John McCain spent as a POW. And obviously this whole White House business, a comment that was said insulting, but probably, you know, meant as some kind of a stupid joke. It's hard to know.
Right.
But the fact that the White House cannot apologize for that. And maybe those two things are connected, that if you apologize, if the person who works for the White House who made the comment about John McCain over the weekend, if she apologizes, then does the president have to apologize for what he said?
Right. It's definitely a no apologies White House. I would also say that there is a viciousness that we've seen in terms of public name calling that's unprecedented. The Trump White House, and particularly this president, feels things deeply personally, right? And is unvarnished in his personal criticism, I think, of reporters that he mocked on the campaign trail, the way that he characterizes his Democratic opponents in Congress. I mean, there is language used that has not been used. At the same time, he is resolutely unapologetic, and I think that this is an after effect of that, right? Something wrong was a wrong was clearly made, right?
No question.
Should be apologized for. And it costs them very little, actually, right? Just to say it was a terrible, terrible joke and I'm sorry. It is, you know, I will tell you, there are some Trump supporters that react very positively to that defiance and think, why should we have to apologize? There's a sense of grievousness. To a prisoner of war who has served his country admirably, faithfully for his life, as he is ailing, the inability to muster up some sort of contrition is, you know, it's shocking, but it's also part of this play. I mean, Donald Trump didn't get to be where he is by, I think, feeling like he had to play by the rules. And the defiance is a determinative part of his DNA. And so in some way, I would not be surprised at all if they continue down this path.
I saw some clips of you going to Russia.
Yeah.
And interviewing RT and getting that sense of what that country, maybe some of the parallels between the two countries.
Definitely. The Russian propaganda machine is as effective. So there's two prongs of it. One is just the misinformation. It's just everyone is bought in and is selling the same misinformation. Complete denial about poisoning, complete repudiation of international conclusions, international agreements on things like the Sergei Skripal poisoning, right? That has the intended effect of, I think, ginning up nationalist support among older Russians. The other thing it does is it sows kind of chaos and confusion among younger Russians who also get their news from other social media networks. And just the younger Russians I talk to just kind of have a feeling of malaise and they share this idea that it's all kind of broken and corrupted. So what's the point? And that, if anything, is the more insidious part of the sort of Russian propaganda machine, I think,
because the people have given up.
Yeah. And the young people who've given up. Right. Because in theory, they're the ones that are going to need to run the country. Mm-hmm. can, you know, sort of decide Russia's role on the world stage in the coming years. And there's a huge amount of apathy. But, you know, I think there are some parallels here in terms of echo chambers, misinformation, concerted messaging efforts at the expense of actual news and facts. And you do have a generation of Americans who in some cases don't believe in institutions and don't want to participate in the building up and the sort of the furthering of institutional survival.
You mentioned talking to voters all across the country. Are there people that you want to interview, I mean, that maybe haven't been interviewed, or maybe people that have been interviewed by everyone under the sun, but you want to get their hands on them?
I'm going to say something that, but maybe this is an adjacent answer to your question. No, this isn't an answer. I think, honestly, the campaign stuff is very exciting. The palace intrigue stuff is very exciting. The flip side of that is also equally exciting. There are a whole host of people whose voices basically remain silent. There are 300,000 residents of this country who are going to get deported in short order. We don't talk about there's so much noise happening on Russia and then the sort of defiant reaction against Russia that we rarely get into the immediate effects on people's lives. There are a lot of people who are touched by decisions in this country being made by this administration, and we are not talking to them enough. Mm-hmm. And then, as a side note, I want to interview Melania Trump because honestly, Marty, who doesn't? Like, the person that knows so very much and has been just completely silent, a sphinx, a cipher. Incredibly consistent.
How would you get beyond?
I will never. I don't think anybody will.
Talk about a face, right?
She's just... Well, it was just shocking yesterday that we found out she went in for overnight inpatient surgery. Also, Donald Trump did not go to the hospital for the surgical procedure. But that nobody knew about that until after it had happened. You talk about a story of dueling wings of the White House. The West Wing is the leakiest wing in, modern American history. And the East Wing, it's like the Mueller probe. Nothing gets out of there. Who knew?
So she's like Mueller, and
Melania
and
has
Trump
much more,
is like the
at
West
least
Wing.
In terms of information habits. I'm not sure about anything else, but yes, it's been impressive.
Do you miss hosting on MSNBC?
I gotta say, it's a grind right now, right? The circus is a totally different muscle group. I feel alive and in the moment in a way that I don't think I ever have as a journalist. I love both of the things. Mm. I'm really glad that I'm doing this now. I just think, especially in this moment, I don't want to be sitting at a desk. I want to be out there, and that's what I get to do, and I'm really blessed. And I will also say CBS is a wonderful place to work, and I continue, you know, you'll see me at the anchor desk every couple weeks on CBS This Morning. So it's not that I've had to entirely give that up.
And did you want to be a journalist when you were a little girl?
I was I started as the restaurant reviewer in my elementary school paper, the March Monitor. I was an editor at The Real Deal. I worked for the College Hill Independent at Brown. I have always wanted to be a journalist. There was no question.
Well, I'm thinking about a restaurant reviewer when you were in elementary
school. When I was in I was in fifth grade. And like, I just remember my teacher, who was the editor of the paper, was like, I don't really know that we need a restaurant review section. There, people are 10 and mostly going out with their parents. But if you would like to review Armand's Pizzeria, be my guest.
Oh, that's great. Does that mean you're a good eater?
Yeah, I mean, I married a chef. I think that was a prerequisite, right?
A chef who worked for the Obamas.
Yes, and ran all their food policy. So food is a big deal in our house.
Well, Alex Wagner, it's been a great pleasure. Thank you so much for taking
Thank
the train
for having
and
me.
Joining us on Radio Times. And again, Alex Wagner, our guest. Her book is called Future Face. It's a memoir, a family mystery, an epic quest, and the secret to belonging. And again, she also is a co-host on The Circus. She's also a correspondent for CBS News and a contributing editor at The Atlantic. And tonight she'll be speaking at the Free Library of Philadelphia, and that is at 7:30. Go to whyy.org/radiotimes to find out more about the program. You can download a podcast of the show, find us on Facebook, and follow us on Twitter. Diana Martinez, the engineer for today's edition of Radio Times. The show is produced by Debbie Builder and John Ahrens. I'm Marty Moscoe. Thank you for joining us.